be the filler if the void is solely yours. I don't wanna be your glass of single malt whiskey hidden in the bottom drawer. And I don't wanna be a bandage if the wound is not mine. Lend me some fresh air. I don't wanna be adored for what I merely represent to you. I don't wanna be a babysitter, you're a very big boy now. I don't wanna be a mother, I didn't carry you in my womb for 9 months. Show me the victor. Visiting hours are 9 to 5, and if I show up at 6:10, will I already know that you'll find some way to sneak me in and go?
I never know how to intro these things. I guess what I would say is that we have a special guest, a new person on the pod this week, which is Gail, who recently today joined the blog. And so she's joining in Cynthia's absence this week. And yeah, we're really excited because this is a really interesting episode to kick off the new season. I think we all had kind of different feelings about it, some good, some whatever, but I think it'll be a good conversation. So maybe let's start and kind of everyone sort of say what they thought about the episode in a nutshell.
I really liked it. I thought it was a really good start to the season, and it's the first episode, it's the first premiere that I've watched of Homeland in real time that actually made me want to watch more. Mm-hmm. So it's got that going for it. I only watched seasons 5 and 6 in real time. God help me. But I'm excited for season 7.
I felt like it was very ambitious. I still, the jury's out for me whether I liked it or not. If that's, I don't know. I felt like there was so much to tackle. They had a lot of things left over from season 6 that rightfully picked up. While they were, I think, ambitious in adding in a very specific direction that you can almost see starting to take shape, you know, for this season, and I think to round it out in episode or season 8 as well. So I felt like there was just so much going on that it was ambitious, and it was harkened back to those early episodes of, you know, Homeland that made me fall in love with the show. So there was a familiarity and a nostalgia that I loved. And I think it can only build from there, which makes me intrigued, and it makes me excited, and it makes me happy to be watching again.
And you posted on LiveJournal last night, maybe, about Sarah's very most favorite thing, parallels. Did you see that, Sarah?
Okay, I like skimmed LiveJournal just to sort of see what was happening. And I saw that Gail had 2 posts, but I didn't have the chance to read them fully. I didn't know that there was like a LiveJournal word limit. I was like, huh, she had to make 2 posts. But just really quickly, I think that I'm probably, I liked it. I mean, I did, and I was surprised. I was like pleasantly surprised that I liked it, because I had basically, you know, below floor level expectations, and was kind of just like, I don't know. I think I had a little bit of like a come to Jesus moment with myself a few weeks ago, where I was like, look, you're not going to stop watching this show, even though the creators like don't care as much about it as you do. And, you know, even though this character died and the fandom left and blah, blah, blah. I was like, you're not going to stop. And but I also kind of, I think, you know, had this sort of reckoning where I was like, the show will never, or the show definitely might not honor Carrie in the way that you want. And it might not honor, you know, these relationships in the way that you want or expect or need. But, like, it could still be good TV. And so I had really low expectations. I think I was preparing for it to be bad, actually. I was preparing for it to just be, like, ugh, like a slog. And it was the opposite of that for me. And I can't even – it's hard to kind of articulate the difference in – feeling I had after watching the season 7 premiere versus the season 6 premiere. If you guys remember, the season 6 premiere was released like 2 weeks early or something, like right before New Year's of 2016.
And we really had to twist your arm to make you watch it.
Yeah, I was like dreading watching it. I was like in such a icky place with the show. And then I watched it and it was like Quinn. It was like it was like really depressing. It was actually very grim. And I was like, right? Like he gets like he's in the whorehouse and he's smoking crack and then like all this other shit. And I was like
there's nowhere this can go but up.
No, but it was so bleak. It was so bleak and I just felt really disengaged from the show at that point. And so I think too,
like that, what you're describing, that bleakness, do you feel like part of that was because that focus was so pulled from who Carrie was that we had all fallen in love with? Like, I think when season 6 opens, she is just completely shut off, not necessarily emotionally, but that intuitive, relentless, obsessive intelligence officer is completely disengaged.
She's drained. And
I think that was a part of it. I think a major part of it was I was not prepared for what they'd done to Quinn at all on any level. I thought that I was going to be prepared, and what they did, I was just like, it just made me feel really shitty. I was like, this, like, it wasn't fun to watch at all. I did not have fun watching it. I remember I watched it with my mom because I was in Atlanta for Christmas break or whatever, and I was just like, wow, like, that was just not, like, I don't want to watch the rest of the season. It just wasn't, but I felt so different watching, like, this was the first episode of the show that I've, like, legitimately enjoyed watching in probably 2 years, at least 2 years. Like, I found myself laughing. There were a lot of really great lines. I thought that the dialogue was really good, and it was intriguing, too, like, I don't know. I felt like the plotting and sort of the pace and the clip of it was really interesting. There were some scenes that I didn't really care about. Like, I don't really care about the O'Keefe storyline, but it didn't feel like it was taking up like a lot of chunks of the episode. And even during those scenes, I felt like the dialogue was actually pretty lighthearted. So I don't know. It was just really enjoyable for me. And like, no one was more surprised about that than I was, and I'm kind of with Ashley. Like, actually, I'm with the both of you. Like, I'm excited to kind of see what they do next, and I hate myself for it, but I think that I have expectations and hopes. I don't know. Like, I feel like that's the curse of the show, is that they kind of like pull you in, and you're like, ugh, like,
and then they shred your soul.
Yeah, but I guess one thing too that I was thinking about last night, just the difference between what I experienced last night watching season 7 and kind of what I'm expecting versus seasons 5 and 6 specifically, because season 6 was garbage. It was bad. Season 5 was also not that great. It was kind of a slog to get through, I think, but I felt like those seasons were a lot about just things sort of unraveling. Like, they start from kind of a place of more or less equilibrium. Right at the beginning of season 5, Carrie's in Berlin. She has a happy life, which made it all the worse to kind of see it fall apart. At the beginning of season 6, Carrie and Quinn, they are in a little bit of an equilibrium state. Carrie is kind of becoming accustomed to this routine in New York. Quinn is kind of, he's not making, I guess, a lot of progress in terms of his prognosis, I suppose. And then it just becomes, you know, even worse from there. The difference that I felt with this episode is I felt like we came in a little bit on the middle of the things where things are already kind of out of control and they're already sort of spinning out of control. Like, past seasons, it would take a few episodes to kind of get into, like, okay, what's this really about? Mm-hmm. And, like, when is Carrie gonna lose it? And like, this episode from the very beginning, like the very first scene, you know that it's different. Like, so, like, it's totally a different ballgame. And I thought that was really exciting.
I think to capitalize on that too, the music, I think, agrees with you. Yeah. Like, I there's a post that I worked on today talking about the silence at the end of the episode and mm-hmm. the score that plays over the credits. And in my research for that, I went back and literally listened to all the credit rolls from the beginning, because I knew I had heard last night, even I was like, oh, I've heard that score before. Where have I heard that? And it immediately struck me. It was in season two, The Choice. It's the music that plays just as Nazir's body is being dropped into the water.
Oh my God, you're right. It's that
and
bum, bum, bum,
yes,
bum. Oh,
yes, it's the timpani, those drums, those very melodramatic, you know, violin chords. And I was thinking last night, I'm like, I know I've heard that before. And I think it's so interesting that we're at the first episode of a season and they're already at that level of drama, that it's ominous, it's foreboding. I think it's setting a tone. I think from the moment the episode opens on Carrie, the musical score creates its own level of intensity that's only complemented by the camera work and the direction and the actors. But that music, I think, gives credence to your theory, because this isn't just a 7.1 episode. This is They're going to bring this home, and they're going to pack it all in. And I think, much like Carrie, there's a lot of work to be done, right? Like, there's a lot of ground to cover. It's going to be quick. It's going to be fast-paced. And I think all of those parallels is what feels so comfortable to me, because that's what it used to be. That's how fast it used to move. And I just thought it was interesting that music from, you know, 212 is opening 7.1. I thought that was...
Well,
crazy.
Calorie definitely reuses, and I've always appreciated that to some extent, because I can hear his music in anything, and I know it's him.
Mm-hmm. It's very distinctive.
Right. So when I first watched Jessica Jones, I was really distracted by the music, and then I was like, this is Sean Calorie. And lo and behold. But I think that with this season, more than any season since season one, we just don't know what to believe about anything. Hmm. And my whole thought when I was rewatching it today was, I don't know who's good and who's bad. And I was like, maybe Wellington's not a bad guy. Maybe Brett O'Keefe is right. Maybe Dante is just a legit bad dude. I don't trust anything that I was seeing on screen, and I love that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that you're right. I think that the show's always kind of played with that dynamic, though. Like, I mean, that's going back to Brody in season one, where they present you with this guy who's clearly conflicted, and as they sort of introduce more shades to his character, you kind of question, you doubt, you know, has he been turned or what? Like, that's kind of their whole MO. It's is this person on your side or not? And they play with it almost every single season. And I think they usually do it actually pretty well, but you're exactly right. I feel like, you know, Wellington, is he a bad guy or not? I tend to think that I want to trust him. I really want to trust him. Like, Saul is another person where I'm just struggling every single season with, is he good or not? O'Keefe, you know, we're presented and we're, I think, meant to loathe him. And I still kind of do, but also... he was kind of right about the president, like all the things that he was saying last season about how she was tyrannical and all these things, like, turned out to be true. Dante, I don't know. I also want to trust him too, because I don't like watching Carrie get, like, fucked over by dudes. And then there's this whole thing with Carrie. It's just like, is she losing it or what? And I think it's a little bit more interesting because the show has done this sort of Cassandra thing with her so many times, where she is the only person who knows that, like, this is what's happening and no one else believes her. Like, that's a little bit tired and tropey, I guess, at this point. So I guess my hope for what they'll do with Carrie is this, like, yeah, she's right, but I think with her it's more not necessarily maybe is she seeing clearly, but are the methods that she's using sound methods?
I think that this season, from what we've seen of Carrie so far, I feel like this season is going to subvert the whole Cassandra trope. Because
what do you mean by that?
Because I think that in this season, Carrie is so unreliable with her brain chemistry and her decisions and her grief and just all of the unbelievable things that are happening in her government. And I don't think there is any part of Carrie that is thinking rationally.
Oh, so you think it's going to be like the girl who cried wolf and then actually nothing happens?
I mean, I think that normally when you watch shows like this, there's that one character who's always right, who they may not be believed by anybody, they may not use conventional methods for anything, and there may be problems, and you can always sort of count on the fact that they will be right at the end of the day. Like, that's 24 in a nutshell. And I think that... Yes, Drake. 24. And I think that is definitely what they've done with Carrie for the past several seasons. And I think that they're going to just subvert that, because they did that. Quinn was the Cassandra last season.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So Carrie was actually acting really rationally for her last season, for the most part. And I think this season she's going to be in Quinn's place.
Well, don't you feel like, though, I mean, if you think back to Carrie's trajectory, right, even when, you know, in season one or even in season two, you know, when she was on her meds and she's telling them, no, like, he made me, like, trust me, I can, she sees it in that episode with Brody, right? Like, no, he made me. Her instincts have always been viable. And even then, she's been questioned. It's actually rare for Carrie to, you know, have a theory or believe something without being questioned. It's been a token thing since day one. So I think that they are kind of definitely in this episode, when she goes to the parking garage, there's that moment where she's looking at the elevator, waiting to see who comes off of it, right? And you could almost, for that brief instance, kind of see where she's not sure of herself. And I think that's a fun thing to play, because, you know, they want us to question her right now. Where is she at emotionally and stability-wise, as the audience? I think because, as you know, as pointed out, she's maybe not the most reliable narrator right now. But I think ultimately, you know, Carrie's been wrong before, and they've hung her out to dry on it too. So I think that whether she's right or wrong, it will lead to things that will eventually prove her right in some capacity, even if it's not completely accurate. Does that make sense? I think it's going to add up eventually. I do.
That makes sense. I think for me, as like a person who just watches for Carrie, I don't really care as much about whether or not she's right or wrong. I don't really hang my hat on that in any way and just point to like, oh, but she was right. I guess it just doesn't, I don't know. I guess that doesn't matter as much to me. I think it matters to a lot of people. Like, a lot of people like to hark back on the fact that, oh, the CIA would never employ like a person with her background or blah, blah, blah. I don't know. But I think it's more interesting for me to sort of, analyze and sort of at any given point attempt to place her mental state, that just so happens to often coincide with whether or not she's thinking clearly and whether or not her sort of intuition and her gut is telling her the right thing. I mean, there have been points where her gut has not been right. Like, I was just watching the other day, or I guess this was yesterday, but I was watching the scene from The Best, you know, where she has the manic episode, and she, you know, it's one day out from it, and so she's still manic, but she's a little bit sort of back down to earth, I guess. But, you know, she has this feeling in her gut that she has to call Brody, because Brody is the only person who can help her fill in the gap of Nazir's sort of timeline, which is where she's not quite sure, like, what occurred. And like, she actually has a conversation with her dad where he's just like, your gut is telling you this thing, but you have to realize that this is, like, this is not actually, like, what your intuition is telling you. Like, there's good gut and then there's bad gut. And then, but she sort of defies him and she says, nope, nope, this is good. And I was thinking, I was like, if Carrie had, like, not called Brody, her entire life would be different. Like, you can sort of place that in at the beginning of the domino effect, because that's what led to Brody calling Estes, which led to Carrie getting kicked out of the CIA, which like that's the whole chain of events, really, if you think about it. And I was thinking, like, sometimes her gut isn't right. I just think it's interesting to kind of, I guess I have no expectations of her being right or wrong. I just kind of want to see it play out, is what I'd say, I guess.
I agree, but in this case, I just want to also state for the record that I trust Maggie Matheson implicitly, and if she says that Carrie is fucked up, then Carrie is fucked up. Yes, Maggie.
We should talk about Maggie, because last night was a really
great episode. She's my hero.
And she's amazing, and she had a lot of really great zingers last night, and I'm here for Sassy Mags.
She just slips into that character too. I mean, I've seen her on other things, and that look when she sits down on the couch and she, like, settles for a second and gives Carrie that look, it is just so Maggie in that moment. That look that is like, I see you, I see through you, I see all of this. Like, Carrie is, like, naked to her in that moment emotionally. She's like, I get it. You're the only one who can save the world. Totally. Like, she just calls her out. And I find her delivery of that, Amy Hargreaves, the actress, just so spot on. Like, it's that tension, that the way she looks at her body posture, all of it. It's fantastic.
I totally agree. I love the character. I love the actor. I think it's... I'm really excited to see Maggie back. I think that I'm not sure that I appreciated her as much in previous seasons, because she's always sort of framed as the person getting in the way of Carrie having her fun in a little bit. Like, she's always the person like, no, like, you can't go to Beirut or whatever in the beginning of season two, or like, no, like, you really need to take your meds. Like, she's always kind of the person who's kind of, I mean, she's the adult in the room. Like, she is the person before their dad died. Like, she was the glue holding that family together. God bless her, having to deal with a bipolar father and a bipolar sister. Like, she did all of that. I don't think I ever really appreciated her, but I'm not sure that the show kind of explicitly wanted us to. I think you kind of had to really look for it and search for it. Last night, I felt like the show was like, Maggie rules all. Like, Maggie is the queen.
She's the only adult on the entire show,
yeah.
Realistically.
I agree with you, though, about that scene at the end where they have the fight and she sits down on the couch and she just gives her that look. And as I was rewatching it one hour ago, I was thinking kind of about this dynamic of the two of them and how Maggie sort of takes on this role in their relationship as the mom, which older sisters often do, I find. I mean, I have an older sister, so I can kind of relate to Carrie in this instance. But, you know, just sort of thinking about the dynamics of, like, when Maggie was asking, you know, when's the last time that you saw a psychiatrist, and it was very motherly. But I was also thinking, like, Carrie was really, like, raised by a mother. It seemed like their mother was totally absent. She obviously, you know, has this mental illness, you know, she was different, etc. Like, I don't know. I was just thinking about it. I don't know if I have a larger point. It was just something that I was thinking about in terms of the dynamic of their relationship, is that neither of them really had a mom. And in the absence of a mother, Maggie became that. And I think that Carrie both craves that and really needs that, because, I mean, look, Maggie's letting her stay at their, like, beautiful, gorgeous home, like, rent-free with her kid and, like, that's her family. At the other time, it seems a little bit like she resents it and she takes advantage of it. I just thought it was really interesting as I was thinking about it. Like I said, I don't have a larger point. It's just an observation I have about the two of them lacking a real sort of maternal figure in their lives and having to kind of cope with that in that vein.
To your point, though, about Maggie as well, that relationship dynamic, I was rewatching the breakfast scene pretty closely earlier today, because I wanted to hear what was actually being said by the news anchor, right? And in that scene, right as Maggie's walking in, it kind of breaks the trance that Carrie has on this news anchor. And you could see where Leslie Linka Glatter, the director, had zoomed in on Carrie's face mm-hmm. to, like, see this, like, anger and concern and, like, and the focus on, you know, by zooming in on the news anchor, too. Like, it's clear where Carrie's at. And Maggie walks into the room.
She
turns the TV off like she got caught watching porn.
Yes. And then that's exactly what that scene was.
She slides a mask back on her face like, no, cool. Hey, I made eggs. Who's up for them? Like,
yes.
the ability to which the show illustrated Carrie putting that mask on to fake it for everyone, and those close-ups to show you who she really is in these moments, I thought was amazing. Truthfully, I thought it was really well done.
Well, and Maggie's role in this episode makes it even more abundantly clear how badly she was needed last season.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think her absence.
There was like a lot of fucking stuff that was needed last season that was not
there. Well, yes, a lot was needed last season.
Like a coherent story.
Well, I mean, yes, but my whole thing was Maggie's absence last season was incredibly notable with the child protection storyline, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it was just like a throwaway line. She's in Italy, and knowing Maggie the way we do now, or the way we always have, and knowing what she is doing now, it's absurd that Maggie wouldn't have just come home to help.
I don't know. I don't know about that. Maggie was so aggravated with Carrie pulling that crap in season 4. And you have to remember, too, then Carrie had, 3 years where she became responsible for Franny, kind of had that life, you know, that we saw that opened up in Berlin. So I think she had taken some ownership of her life. And I think by doing that, you know, it's kind of unspoken, but obviously Maggie was free to go with her family to Italy, where she probably hadn't been prior to that because of Carrie and because of the dad and kind of that whole situation. So, and I think what's ironic is all last season, I'm like, man, if only Maggie was around to take care of Franny, she wouldn't be in foster care. And I felt like Maggie was the answer to a lot of these problems that Carrie was having custody-wise last year. But in reality, I think we're going to see, even with Maggie around, I don't think, you know, when Carrie flips that switch to go back into spy mode, like we saw, you know, clearly in this episode, that obsessive, all-consuming, side of herself, she hasn't mastered the art of creating space for anything else in there yet. And having Maggie around, I think, is too easy of a crutch for her to not take advantage of.
And that is a really interesting point. Now, yeah. If only they could have justified that in some way last season.
Right. I agree.
In terms of Maggie, I agree with Gail that it's kind of like Carrie's issues aren't so shallow that Maggie can just fix them by being there. Just in terms of her being a mother and not being able to make room in her life for Franny, that's permanent room. Like, Maggie can't fix that just by being there. I really believe that. The other thing I would say specifically related to last season and like, oh, if only, you know, Maggie hadn't been there is a dynamic. And I think this sort of calls back to sort of the maternal sort of relationship that they have where Maggie mothers Carrie and Maggie's always the one who's taking care of Carrie, is that as a younger sister, and you know, I'm not saying that this is like what my relationship is with my sister, but I understand these feelings of that Maggie is so much more stable and has, you know, she has a conventional life, quote unquote, you know, she has the husband, the two kids, the nice house, the job, she's a doctor, all this thing. Like, Maggie has her shit together and Carrie doesn't. And I think that Carrie is not someone who asks, I think, for favors like that so easily. I think that she might be a person, like, it doesn't feel good to have to ask your sister to constantly come and take care of your kid. Like, that doesn't feel good to her. I can't imagine that it would. To some extent, it kind of has to come as a form of pride that, like, no, I can do this. I'm on my own. After, you know, really struggling with it, I can do it. And, like, we're together now. And, like, and, you know, I can be a capable mother for my kid. I almost wonder if Maggie had been in the States and Franny had been able to go live with her, like would Carrie have reached out for fear of, you know, feeling once again like she was failing? It just sort of reinforces that dynamic of Carrie being the screw up in their relationship.
Also notable to me, and this is just a really stupid little point, but I found it significant that Franny has her own room.
Why?
At Maggie's house.
But I mean, come on, that house is massive. I bet
that house is massive. I'm sure.
There's four bedrooms. There's one for Josie, one for Bill, and one for Maggie, one for Carrie, and one for Franny.
Do they just keep Ruby in the attic then? Because, like, we haven't heard about her yet.
She's at college. Ruby's the older one. She's at college. She has to be away at college.
Unless they've erased her from the show, but I hope that's the case. But I think what's neat about Maggie this year and why I think there's going to be more depth to her character is because we haven't really seen that conflict between her and her husband when Carrie comes, really, like when she comes home to roost, right? Mm-hmm. When she calls in these favors. And immediately in episode one, like, Maggie is already at odds with Bill, even from the kitchen scene. Like, she's like, hey, like, give Bill, you know, give him a chance. Like, he's, you know, a scab at work. He, you know, let's not do this here. So there's clearly already a history on top of the fact that, you know, Carrie gets caught. And Bill is not having it. And he had to leave that theater play. Right. And he's aggravated. And, you know, he's out with his wife. And I think for Maggie, this whole season, I think, is going to come down to a couple of things. How does she keep her relationship with Carrie and that dynamic in balance with her relationship with her husband and their family unit, with the other complication that her husband works for the Keene administration, mm-hmm. making him, you know, a collaborator in the eyes of the resistance, right? So I feel like Maggie's got a lot on her plate, and that's a dam waiting to break, and that's going to be really good for, you know, dramatic effect, I think, and honestly,
Bill is 150% going to die.
No way. I don't see Bill dying.
Nope, he's going to die.
I have a question for you guys. Do you guys worry? So, like, I have bought into the, like, familial
conspiracy,
domestic drama of Carrie and Maggie and Bill and all of that. I bought into it, but in large part because I just love Carrie and also I love Maggie a lot. My question is, are we in sort of risky territory of this becoming like Brody family drama, you know, of like seasons two or three where it was just like, oh god, like this is not, like, why are we focusing on this?
I don't think so.
Mm-mm. I think they might have learned that lesson, because you can even tell with Josie, she's not in direct opposition to Carrie. Mm-hmm. She's almost like a mini Carrie in the respects that she's engaged, she's aware, mm-hmm. Almost acutely, it kind of seemed, in a less angsty way. Although she was very Angela Chase in that picture.
I was going to say, she was giving me major
on the couch
Angela Chase vibes last night, like majorly. She looks way younger on camera than she does like in pictures, like on the internet. I was like shocked. I was like, wow, she actually kind of does look like maybe she's 16 or 17 years old, whereas like whenever I've seen photos of her, she looks like probably early 20s, which is probably how old she is. They just made her look really young, and I was surprised at that.
I think one of the issues with the Brody family though was that all of that story and that drama took away from the spy plot. It took away from Carrie. It took away from things that we were really interested in, just to show us some angst. I don't, mm-hmm. like, this is Carrie's family. She's the center character. She's the focal point of the entire show. I think that if there is family drama, and there will be, obviously, I think it will be way more interesting and way more relevant to the story as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, watching Carrie and Maggie sort of spar like that in the way that only sisters really do, in the way that only sisters do, where you can say something that's really, really mean, and then like 3 seconds later be like, I'm sorry, that was like a really bitchy thing to say or whatever.
And they both did that.
Yeah, I know, which is what happened. But like, only sisters can fight and say something really mean, but then just be like, I love you. Like, that's not a thing that actually, like, I don't know. I think that watching that scene was really entertaining because they're such two, like, tremendous actors. And they just totally went there. And the dialogue was really sharp. And I thought the pacing was really good. The direction was great. I mean, I would enjoy watching more scenes like that, actually. So
I would watch an entire series of that.
I was thinking, like, this is kind of embarrassing. But back in my early days of watching the show, so we're talking season 2 about like 2012, which was like almost 6 years ago, if you can believe it. But back in the early Homeland days, you know, season 2, Carrie Brody, and they kind of like set up this thing and in the season 2 finale where they were, you know, talking about them like being together, and she's like, oh, you can be my cabin boy or whatever, at the same time setting up this weird dynamic where like Carrie was the other woman and like potentially like this kind of like weird stepmothery vibe with Dana with the kids. And I'm pretty sure at that point back in 2012, I was like, I would watch like a domestic drama that was Carrie and Brody like trying to form a life, and it would air on like AMC, and I would like the fuck out of that show.
You were crazy.
That would be hysterical.
But like, if you think about it, that's what most fic is. Most fic is like domestic dramas.
That's true, but I'm not sure I'm signing up for the Matheson Madhouse. I don't know. I don't know.
Speaking of, Gail, are you going to finish your fic?
Oh, Lord, girl. Yes, actually. I feel like I stalled a little bit on it because I don't want my fic to be wrong, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like my fic is real and it's going to happen. And I feel like I set it far enough in advance that and left the background details kind of loose.
Wait a second. Ashley, why are you asking Gail if she's going to finish her fic?
Because we already know, right? That I'm going to finish mine.
Don't you
and
have
I know.
One of your own to finish?
Yes, I do.
Yes. Thank you, Sarah.
I fully acknowledge that I am a hypocrite and a half.
Okay. But, I just wanted you to acknowledge that. Go ahead.
But people know. People have asked me multiple times, and I'm honest that I'm still going to finish it. Gail has not been asked these questions publicly before.
Okay, well, now she's on the record.
Now you're on the record.
I will say, on the record, part of me being able to watch the show and talk about it with such passion is that I completely 100% believe that Quinn is on a beach rehabbing right now. So I'll put my crazy out there.
Gail is so taking over the there. Conspiracy.
Okay. I don't know if I'm about I don't want to get involved in proving it. I just need it to be true in my bubble. So I'm gonna live there. Don't poke it. No sharp objects near my bubble.
Let's talk about Quinn, because he wasn't mentioned at all this episode. He was not mentioned in the previously on. No one referenced his name or even the fact that he died like the entire episode. I know that that was a point of major contention and major upset and anger among a lot of people. And I think, you know, rightly so. It is very – I think it's kind of strange and almost bizarre. At the same time, after reading several reviews where, you know, they talked about the fact that he wasn't really mentioned, the – Michael Osiello spoiler thing from a few weeks ago that said, nope, like he wasn't even mentioned at all in the premiere. I think I was more prepared for it, and so I had some time to come to terms with that. What did you guys think about the fact that he wasn't mentioned?
Well, I had so much time to prepare, like you said. So it didn't faze me at all. I knew nothing was coming. So I understand that people were still upset about it, and rightly so. But at the same time, I knew better than to have any expectations, because I knew it wasn't going to happen. So I can't bring myself to be upset about it now, since I already knew.
I think that's interesting. I was upset when I first heard that, right? And that was part of like, God, can I really do this to myself again with the show? And that was kind of that internal, you know, argument I had with myself. But I will say this for the Quinn fans, right? Because I'm in their camp. I absolutely adore his character, because he's still alive. So I don't, you know, it's not past tense. I currently adore him.
He's and
I, but I think had the show handled the death of him, the perceived death of him when he faked it, you know, I wish had they.
It's like talking to me all over again.
The death, quote unquote.
Yeah, right. Had they handled that differently, within their PR machine, within their postmortem, had anything been done differently, with more care, I don't think it would have been as the response would have been as acidic as it has been. And I think what I personally caught from this episode, maybe because I was prepared, so I was, and I had an open mind, I do feel like he colored the entire episode through Carrie. She is not okay. She is as emotionally invested in hunting down this truth like we haven't seen her since Abu Nazir. And even more impassioned, I would say. She took 9/11 very personally.
I mean, she lost someone who loved for no reason.
Oh, yeah. And I think, like, you know, this with Quinn is extremely personal for her. And, you know, we talked about the parallels to 4.1 and that opening jazz scene where we find the drone queen and she's very cold and detached. But that same frenetic, you know, jazz music, here she's running in place, which is ironic, in a bun, you know, which we, you know, she's just uptight and she's wound up and she is wild and relentless. And she's as emotional as we've seen her, truthfully, in years. And I think that what's driving her is the loss of Quinn and what happened to him and this injustice by this government. She has given it all for. She has given up everything and lost so much. How dare they, right? Yeah. So I think he is very much a thread throughout. Even though his name isn't spoken, I do have hopes that they will course correct and address it at some point, because I think his character deserves it. And I think sometimes, you know, showing and not telling is great, but I think sometimes the telling can be effective if done correctly. And I think that there is going to be a time and place for it, because the wheels are going to fall off for her. And her and Saul haven't really talked yet. She hasn't met with that therapist yet. Dar is MIA. There's no way Dar is okay with what happened to Quinn either. So there are things that I think are coming down the pipe. Not, you know, just assumptions, not based on anything that I know, truthfully. I think he's going to have that. There's going to be that. And I just feel like that acidic, you know, response is a shame, because there was so much about Quinn in this episode that could have been viewed differently had the show done their due diligence and, you know, in May.
You know, yeah. I thought they did a pretty good job, though. There were a lot of moments in the episode where I thought about Quinn. Like, he definitely came to mind. He mentioned the elevator scene. The whole McClendon sequence at the end, for me, was very Quinn. It was so reminiscent of the sarin gas chamber. Mm-hmm. Particularly on the second watch. Like, the way he's being hustled down the hallway by a bunch of men and he can't do anything about it, and the way he just accepts what's happening to him. But this was worse. This was utter humiliation and complete stripping him of all of his dignity, everything that he had worked for his entire life, stripping him of his uniform. Like, you saw the way that he was very carefully. Sorry, that's Delta.
He almost like petted, not like petted, but you know, he caressed his right. uniform.
Yeah, that was mm-hmm. that was an interesting detail, the way that he laid the uniform down, and he was being very sort of meticulous in how he was undressing, which was very like, to me, that spoke to his respect for the uniform, you know, more than anything else.
I completely agree. And it was just, to me, the way that he died and the lead up to it was so, it was so long. It was unnecessarily long for a character we've barely even met. And it really felt to me like I feel like in some way they were really doing that to give us something from Quinn, something for Quinn.
After right, I do think Quinn.
I have.
I don't agree with that, but.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we should go back to the last scene because I have a lot to say about it, and I thought it was really interesting. Mm-hmm. I have several thoughts on what we've been talking about related to Quinn and the parallels to the Drone Queen and everything that I wrote them down so that I wouldn't forget. Okay, so my first thing is this, and that it's, I told this to several people, it's just that, and I was reading back through the blog in the pre-season 4 days, I think, or maybe it was like as season 4 was airing, because Carrie's season 4 behavior was so jarring and so offensive to a lot of people, rightly so, I guess. I mean, she did like sleep with Ion and then like had him like basically led him to his death. Like, that's a thing that happened. People were really, like, deeply offended by that. Like, really, really offended. And I just kind of have to be take the Carrie that we have in seasons 1, 2, and 3 and compare it to the Carrie in season 4. That's not the same person. Like, you can't, like, there are sort of through lines there that are the same, but it's not really the it's not really kind of the same person. So when someone experiences a change in behavior that's that sharp and that drastic, there's a reason why. And it's not her illness flipping on and off. Like, actually, if you think about it, the fact they made an explicit point to just be like, to for her to say that she was taking her meds twice and that like this was the thing that was happening just goes to show that her illness can't be blamed for all of this. Like, you can't just pin it on that. Blame's not the right word, but you can't just say this is the reason that she's acting like this. It's because she's manic. She's going through a manic episode. So when someone experiences that really sort of sharp turn in behavior, there's a reason why. And in season 4, the reason why is because she was grieving over Brody, and she was trying to come to terms with having this child that she couldn't connect with and that she couldn't even like look at, and coming to terms with the guilt she had over letting Brody die in the way that she did when, you know, as she said later on, like, she knew what was going to happen and she did it anyways, and the guilt that she felt over that. My feeling regarding Carrie in relation to Quinn in season 7 is that until it's proven to me otherwise, all of her behavior is directly related to losing Quinn, and losing Quinn when she said that she couldn't lose another one. And also the way that he died, which was sacrificing himself for a president that turned out to be not worth the sacrifice. Because it's not like Carrie just turned this way right after he died. She was deeply, deeply sad and seemed a little bit detached and kind of running a mile a minute, but still kind of, I think, kind of had a little bit of, she was more stable. Like, when we saw her in the season 6 finale, you know, and she was talking to Saul when she was in the White House or whatever, she was like more or less like stable. She wasn't a lot of like a sort of ball of sort of frantic energy. The point at which the sort of rubber band snapped is after Keen sort of turned on her, right? Because that's the point at which his sacrifice and his dying to save a president, dying as a hero, well, now the person that he died to save and that he died to protect has turned into the antithesis of everything that he believed in. And that, I think, is what's really gotten her to this place.
That betrayal.
Yes, exactly. It's a betrayal. It's a betrayal of who Quinn was. And until it's proven otherwise to me, I'm thinking that all of her behavior is a direct result of that. Because you can't explain it in any other way. You can't just explain it by saying, oh, Quinn is a fascist. What? Well, like, whatever. It's like,
say Quinn is a fascist?
Sorry, Keen, not Quinn. Sorry. Keen is a fascist. I wonder what that meant. Sorry, you can't explain it away by her just believing that Keen's a fascist and a dictator, blah, blah, blah. Like, sure, she believes those things, but she wouldn't be having that kind of obsessive and sort of tunnel vision energy to bring her down if it wasn't for Quinn. So that's my first point, my really long first point. My second point, I have like a few more, I think. Okay, so my second point, going back, I think Gail brought this up, just the parallel between the way that this season started with the Jazz and also at the beginning of season four, you have the Jazz as well. I watched both those scenes last night and the Jazz music is so different. And the way that those scenes play is really, really different. So in season four, it opens up. She's in the car. She's very sort of, she's basically still. She's very laconic. She's walking kind of slowly. Her face isn't moving. It's very still. And the Jazz music itself is it's not so frantic at all. I mean, it's still jazz. It's still unpredictable, but it's a lot of sort of lower bass tones. I wish I knew more about music. This might be a bad description.
It's quieter too.
Right. It's a lot
it's
quieter.
Not as blaring. Right.
Yeah, totally. It's a lot quieter. It's much, I mean, like, it's not calming isn't probably the right word.
It's subdued.
Yeah, it's much more subdued. This, when you turn it on, so first of all, she's like running, she's sweating. I really love the way that you describe it. She's like running in place. I thought that's such an interesting sort of metaphor for her scenario right now, because if you think about it, in season four she's actually running around in circles. She's running around like the block of the embassy or something like that, running in circles, and now she's running in place. But you know, at least she's moving. But this Jazz, it's so it's kind of like nails on a chalkboard a little bit. Like, it's really in your face. It's like, I don't know, like I don't know the right terms for this musically, but it's kind of jamming in from the walls, from the outside in, and nothing kind of makes sense. It's blaring. It's uncomfortable. It's totally, totally different. My third point, and this might be my last point. My third point is that I was thinking last night as I was watching the scene where she's talking to Dante about, you know, I know you thought that you know, the most important work you'd ever do in your life is to bring down Terrace. But what if this is?
And thinking, oh, yes.
And thinking
she's
about
talking
Terrace,
to herself.
Well, she is. But I was thinking about the way that she kind of – there's a pep talk kind of at the end of this episode. There's also a pep talk at the end of 401, too, where she's talking to Quinn in the – airport, I think, and you know, he's talking to her about, you know, the job or whatever, and you know, I don't remember the exact words that he says. Everyone knows the scene. It's a really sort of famous and loved scene, and you know, he's like, oh, but you can't bring dependents and all this other stuff, and she's like, well, it's a job is what she says. Like, it pays more money, it's just a job to her. And like, here in season seven, she doesn't even have, like, she doesn't have a proper job, but it's work. Right. It's like her life's work is to do this. And you can sort of, you can place the difference and kind of the passion and the intensity that she feels going after Keen as her target in season seven versus going after, like, unknown terrorist via drone. Like, it's the complete opposite in terms of the work that she's doing, right? The drones were so impersonal and they were so detached, right? It was killing people via remote control, you know, as Quinn said. And this is like real, like, work. She's like on the ground doing kind of the day in and the day out, and you can tell that she's energized by it in a way. Like, the scene at the end where she's watching Wellington, like, I haven't seen Carrie, like, I haven't seen that kind of expression on her face in a really long time.
The last time Carrie was passionately tracking someone was Abu Nazir. We've seen her, you know, the drone queen. You're right. Totally impersonal. Even Hakani, like, she wasn't really the driving force. It was Quinn. You know, when she was trying to figure out, you know, the plot at Hupenough, they were nameless, faceless people. And she was more, it was almost like she was just following a lead. It wasn't like this emotional stake in it to the same degree. And I think that's what, I think that's all such great points about comparing 4 to 7, is that it's even more proof how she's coming back full circle, how, you know, she's tried life away from the spy game. She's tried denying that side of herself. Here she is, maybe, you know, starting to embrace it again when she probably truthfully needs it most, right? Like, she has given up everything for this country.
Yeah.
And I don't know how disheartening for her to have it all have been for what? For nothing. For this, to have this president in place that, you know, has ruined her life in a lot of ways. And she just feels so betrayed by that and what's been done to Quinn.
Yeah. And two, I think another reason that it's really interesting is, you know, when Quinn died, we were like, oh, great. Another person that Carrie loved who died and she was kind of directly involved. Like, didn't we just go through this in season 4? I mean, not just, but it was kind of like, haven't we seen this before? Like, how is this new? And I was really worried that they wouldn't be able to portray her grief or the kind of the aftermath of that differently enough from season 4 that it would feel like something worth watching. But, you know, just based on the first episode, it seems like they've done that in a really interesting way. We've talked a lot about how different her behavior is between seasons 4 and 7 so far, and I think it'll probably persist. Like, Carrie's grief in season 4 was just, it was denial, and it was just kind of pretending that it didn't happen and it didn't exist, pretending that she didn't have this kid and, you know, all this other thing. It was like making up this story in her head of what had happened that wasn't true. And I feel like season 7, she's just like letting herself feel everything. And it's leading to, you know, her becoming unreliable and, you know, just watching her, you know, throughout the day, because the episode takes place over a single day, but just watching that, you know, from start to finish. The second that she leaves the kitchen at the beginning of the day and she goes upstairs to get the box, it's like she's, I don't know, it's like she's a ball of energy. And like, it was, I felt like acute, I don't know, I felt like really anxious watching her, because like she
could always feel anxious watching her.
Right. But like she couldn't sit still. And it was oh my God, I was a little bit like, this is like, I felt like nervous watching it, because you could tell that she couldn't sort of be still at all.
Well, I think there's a point to be made about the difference between Brody's death and Quinn's death and the aftermath of both, is that Carrie took on the responsibility of Brody's death. Of course she was going to shut down entirely, because she was facing what she had done, what she had not done, what she could have done differently. She'd lost someone that she loved, and in her mind, it was all her fault. In this instance, she has somebody to blame, and she wants to take them down. So she's got that single-minded focus. Because there's a face to the person that Quinn died for no reason, for the person who betrayed her so much, for all of this. And I think that whereas in season 4, she just detached completely because she shut down, I think in this instance, she's really just trying to avenge him.
Yeah, that's a good
point. She has someone to fight, finally.
All right, let's go back to that last scene, that last sequence where McClendon, well, I think there's kind of a lot to discuss about that last scene. So just sort of to set the picture, McClendon is sentenced and the jury comes back really quickly and says, no, we're not going to execute him. It's life in prison, and Keene is up in arms because it just shows that she doesn't have any power and no one respects her. And she tells Wellington to, quote, fix it. And then that's kind of the last we really hear about that until we see him walking into the sentencing hearing at the same time that Carrie has now eyes into Wellington's house and she's watching him on the screen. So she's watching him, you know, watch the news juxtaposed with McClendon being sort of led into this room where he has to undress. And, you know, we talked about the way that he undressed and the sort of meticulousness with which he sort of laid out his clothes and everything like that. And then, of course, he dies. He has a heart attack. And it's clearly one of the guards has, I don't know, like rubbed something on his cheeks or his ears or something like that. We were talking about it earlier. Tongue. Yeah.
I think it's his tongue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when he stuck his tongue out for the, like, the mouth inspection or whatever and maybe, like, play some sort of chemical agent or something that caused him to have a heart attack. I was so nervous during that entire scene because I kept expecting McClendon to have some sort of, like, shiv in his armpit or something. And I was expecting him to kill the guards, which I know is legitimately insane, but I was expecting like something crazy like that to happen. And and then as he was having a heart attack, I was like, am I watching the pacemaker like fiasco all over again? Because it kind of played out again. Like, that's like, okay, someone has like a spontaneous heart attack, what's going on? But
apropos of nothing,
I really, really enjoyed that last sequence. I didn't get the sort of Quinn subtext from it that Ashley did, but what I really appreciated and loved about it is it was so tense.
I'm apparently the only one who got that.
It was so tense, and it was so well done and really well edited. Like, I like the way that they interspersed Carrie watching Wellington with what went on. I really liked the last scene that they did, which was the guard from behind putting the gloves into the Ziploc baggie as they sort of zoomed in on the screens. It felt like season one or season two of the show. It felt like sort of vintage. I really enjoyed it, but I did not understand the like Quinn references at all that you were talking about.
Well, I might be the only one who got that, but apropos of nothing, except we got a few asks about this over the fall when the Me Too moment began. Robert Knepper, who played McClendon, mm-hmm. has been accused by several women of sexual assault. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot today is
that was all filmed and written before that stuff came out.
But it wasn't edited before that stuff came out.
Okay.
And I wonder how much of the way it came across on screen is sort of a result of that.
I think were trying to be kind of like malicious in the way that they edited it and like really cold and heartless.
I think so. Okay. I think that might be part of it. You know how they like to be prescient.
I know, but you don't necessarily want to call attention to the fact that an actor that's been on your show has been accused of sexual assault. Like, that's not something you want to allude to.
Yeah, I don't think they had that in mind. Well,
I don't think so
either. I did
a
little research on the editor. It's a male editor, which, I mean, maybe I should give him more credit. Maybe he is part of the Me Too movement. I don't know. But I think they're lucky to get out with that only being his only episode. I think they're getting out of, you know, kind of the drama of what happens to these people who stay associated to the shows they're on. So I think they're kind of getting off the hook on that with him. But I think, you know, there's so many uncomfortable parallels to the Quinn scene in season 5, right? And I think it's really meant to show, like, even when Quinn was being led to the gas chamber, he had his clothes on. And he had someone who, along the way, tried to help him survive it. Like, he had people who were looking out for him, that he had people trying to find him, trying to save him. McClendon had none of that. It was like all of his, you know, chickens had come to roost. It was, his time was up. And I think that the show made a point of it being silent and zooming in on it, because even in death, he had lost that final dignity of what that journey of death is supposed to be. And I just thought it was really poignant.
So is that some sort of like, two. Is that some sort of like karmic justice or something? Because McClendon is the person who he killed Quinn. Like, it was his direct orders that led to that. Oh, so you're saying that it was a Quinn sort of.
It was a karmic reward for the viewers who watched Quinn die and who suffered.
Okay, but that's like, I didn't even get that until you just said that like 10 minutes ago, Ashley. And I watched this show really obsessively. So do you really think that the average viewer got that?
Well, no, because none of you people got that, but that is what I got from it. And that's what I was thinking as it was happening. And clearly I am the only person, at least in our small sample, who got that. But that's...
I think it's totally possible that's what they were going for. It's totally possible. But if you're trying to do some sort of karmic justice for this character that was on the show for 5 years and that wasn't mentioned at all during the episode, wouldn't you do it a little bit more obviously?
I felt like the homage was pretty obvious.
I didn't get it at all. Come on.
I do not get nuances at all of like literally anything. So like, I'm really excited to have like caught this one thing. Like, I just watch shows and see what's happening. This is the one time that I get to say this is what's happening. So this is what's happening.
I think it's an interesting theory, but I'm not sold on that as their intent.
Yeah, I know, but I'm right a lot.
Okay, whatever.
That's true.
You were wrong today.
I was wrong today.
What did you guys think about the... So besides Ashley thinking that it was a karmic reward for Quinn and Ashley being the only person who picked up on that, you know, I thought that it was kind of like vintage Homeland in the best way. Gail, what did you think?
With McClendon, you mean?
Yeah.
That scene?
At the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they were trying to... I think with showing both sides of it, right, not only were they showing this death that we feel is kind of justified, but in reality, it's murder. Mm-hmm. And I think they're letting that settle on us as viewers. I think they're demonstrating just how cruel this is and that's happening. So I think it's very homeland to show that. I'm sorry, what'd you say, Ashley?
It was ordered by the president, basically. And I wonder,
mean that the president... So it was... When she said fix it, it was very clear that she was like, fix this, kill him. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he did he carried out that order. And that's what it seems like from like the preview, is that someone is trying to like make it look like the White House did this in order to like remove her from office or something like that.
Oh, you know, I haven't actually watched the preview yet.
Okay, so well, that's what the preview suggests.
I forgot. But that was one of the things that I was thinking about when I was watching it this afternoon, was that she explicitly said, like, I'll find somebody who will take care of it. And David Wellington, side note, how many characters named David do we need?
Miss David Estes.
I know. David Exley sounds like too much like David Estes. It's stupid.
Anyway, the fact that David Wellington is a guy and David Estes was a guy probably means that David Exley won't be a guy. You can't have two Davids on your show, right? Well, you can't have David W and David E.
That's his alias. He's not on the show. He's on a beach.
Oh, yes, right. Okay. So, right. I forgot.
But my whole thought is just with Wellington being portrayed from the get-go as this bad dude who is just orchestrating everything. Senator Paley wants him out. There are leaks. I think that he's going to turn out to be, you know, an okay dude.
I didn't get the sense from this episode at all that he was like a bad guy at all. He seemed like he was stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, the rock being The Rock being the president. Like,
The Rock has an HBO show.
The Rock has an HBO show. But he seems like he's stuck between a rock and a hard place. The president is, like, paranoid as fuck. And she's, like, ordering people to come into his home for, like, a bug sweep. She's, like, crazy person.
Well, she didn't. Max was there.
Really,
like,
to
Max.
Call a woman crazy. But, like, it's so weird. And so like, she's paranoid. She won't listen to his advice, which is, like, sound, rational, reasoned advice. At the same time, she's also just like, I rescued you from political exile. And, like, you know, if you can't figure out how to make this work, then you can go back to political exile. Like, he's really stuck. And so I thought it was interesting that he reached out to Saul. We haven't talked really about Saul this entire time.
Oh my God,
I thought it was
Saul
interesting that he reached out to
good.
Saul. It's like, Saul is the answer to my problems. Like, Saul can fix this.
Well, I mean, I think I want to know more about his background and what he was doing that caused him to be in so-called political exile.
I guess
the fact that he is going
that,
to Saul is interesting.
Yeah. I guess my thoughts are that I felt like he was portrayed really sympathetically in the episode, actually. Like, I felt sympathy for him.
I don't know, man. I think we're not supposed to know how we feel about him. I think that, you know, Carrie doesn't trust him, so there's a little bit
That's
of
true.
An assumption that we're not supposed to either, right?
But we can't trust Carrie right now.
I do, well, good point. And I also feel like the enemy of my enemy is my friend to some degree, mm-hmm. right? So it's kind of like, you know, Keen, you know, the Brett Keefe resistance with Keen, right? Mm-hmm. So there's parts of it where we're like, yeah, get rid of her. We agree, Brett, you know, like, tone down the menopause, you know? And then with David, we're like, you're the reason why there's the 200 are jailed. That's not great. And here he is now, kind of living with the spiral that Keen has, you know, this death spiral she's in of paranoia and, you know, probably inefficiency and this, the government now is actively working to thwart her. And he's kind of like, oh, okay, how do I get control back? And I don't know if that makes him a good guy or a bad guy. I think it makes him interesting because clearly she's got blackmail. She pulled him out of this exile mm-hmm. that you mentioned, she's got him on the ropes. So that makes people susceptible, which is why you have to, you know, in a normal government, pass background checks and all this stuff. But even in our current country, you can see where, you know, there aren't enough people to fill the positions because there aren't enough people left that haven't besmirched the person that they would be working for. And I think you're seeing some of that probably with Keen. And that's why she has someone working for her like that, is that I bet you the list of people to take that job was short. And I think they're probably I'm making assumptions on that. But I think what's going to be interesting about David is, are we going to see him as the bad guy if he is? Or would we be like, oh, okay, we understand why he did that now. She's nuts. You know what I mean? Like, I think they've set it up to be really dynamic in its in his arc.
Yeah, I think that just hearing you talk about it, I was just thinking, like, season 5 and season 6, the show's been so sort of hellbent on doing these, like, reboots every season where it's, like, new characters, new story, new location every year. And it worked really well in season 4. You have to remember in season 4, the first two episodes premiered at the same time on the same night, and those two episodes laid a lot of groundwork for what the season was going to be about, and they were really jam-packed with stuff. And so you kind of did feel energized by it, and it was a brand new location. Season 5 and season 6, like, those seasons were much more sort of slow burns, but it's also because you couldn't just place the viewer in the middle of this thing with all these new characters and not just be like, well, this person is Otto, this is Sekou Bot. Like you couldn't just do that. Like, you had to take the time to sort of introduce the character and be like, this is where Carrie is now, and this is where she lives, and this is her job. Like, you had to do all those things. I had to say, one of the benefits of them extending season 6 into season 7, just in terms of the characters and the overall story and, you know, location just being in the United States, is that you don't have to waste time doing that. And I think that the premiere actually really benefited from that because it felt a lot more tightly paced. It didn't feel like the season five or season six premieres at all, where it was kind of just like laying the groundwork. Like you said kind of at the beginning, it was extremely ambitious. They covered a lot of territory and there's a lot of moving parts, and like we've been talking about this for like over an hour and we already have like a lot of theories, and I think that's because we have the backgrounds with all of these characters. Like we kind of know a little bit like where we stand, where we know who they are, and we can sort of connect, you know, what they did in season six to season seven. Like I never thought that I would actually be saying that. I was one of those people who was like, I don't care about the United States anymore, like move on, like this isn't that interesting. I was extremely skeptical of what they would do with the president, because involving the president in the storyline this way just feels like a really, or I think for a long time it really felt like a very un-Homeland thing to do, because kind of like the president was never really involved. We never even knew who the president was. It was always people below the president. And so like involving the president in that way just didn't feel like a very sort of in character thing to do for the show. But I have to say, I was like pleasantly surprised. I like liked what they did with Keane. I felt like they kind of just like went there, and I appreciated them for not really towing the line in that way and just being like, this is who she is. People think that she's a fascist. She's super fucking paranoid and she's like gone off the rocker. It sets up an interesting parallel with Carrie in that way.
Well, one thing that I just wanted to circle back to, sorry, Gail. One thing that I wanted to circle back to, just because you brought up the fact that season six bleeding into season seven means that we sort of know the characters, was that it became really super fucking obvious when Carrie was recounting her history with Dante. And you're like, they've been in contact for a while. He's been leaking things to her. Like, they've been... Mm-hmm. And yet they were explaining stuff to us, the audience, and it was so obvious.
That doesn't bother me.
There's
like some things that bother me and some that don't.
I was just trying to think of why that like had stood out to me before, like when I was watching it. I was trying to think of why I was noticing that, and I think that's it.
I guess I can fan wink about that though, because it did come at an important moment. Like she did have to give him a pep talk and be like, this is why you did this. This is why you reached out to me. Like, we have this history. Like, the one awkward line in that exchange was when she was like, oh, I'm really sorry that they laid the clusterfuck at your feet, which was really weirdly delivered by Claire. Like, that was, I think, the one line in that that I was like, that was bizarre. But I think the rest was interesting. And I'm also intrigued about, like, what happened in Afghanistan. Like, what happened in Kabul? And how do they know each other? And what's going on with him? Because
weren't they pronouncing it Kabul in season four?
What?
Weren't they pronouncing it Kabul in season four?
Oh my god, I don't know. I say Kabul.
I know. That was distracting.
I wanted to say that one of the things I appreciated in this episode that I think gave me hope for my decision to watch it was that this prescient bullshit that for me has derailed their season five and six storylines and the character building and all the things that I thought they had done so well in the first, you know, four seasons was this chase for prescience, right? Mm-hmm. And this need to, you know, try to intuit what was going to happen in the world. And we saw, you know, through, you know, interviews that Alex Gonza did and Leslie Linka Glatter and whatnot, you know, in season six, where they were like, yeah, you know, we filmed eight episodes and then the election happened. And then, oh, my God, you know, I was pacing and we, you know, we kind of went back to the drawing board for those last four episodes. And I remember being like irate when I read that, like, how dare you let Trump ruin our story when he's ruined everything else? Like,
right.
I
was like, ruined so our lives.
Inherently mad. But I feel like that chase for prescience that was so damning to them has oddly taken a back seat, even though they're prescient in the story to some degree with the Trumpism, the Alex Jones-ishness, I mean, of Brett O'Keefe.
It totally
I just
has.
Feel like
you can't.
It's become, right. Yes, it's become a tool in their toolbox, and it's no longer their driving force.
Yeah,
and I think they're letting these stories talk, which is so interesting to me because that's the show I loved. That's the show that won awards, not this other crap.
Yeah.
Well, I think season five was kind of accidentally prescient. and they got hooked on it.
Threw a whole bunch of shit at the wall and just saw what stuck. There was like the
Fact that the bombing literally happened the day they were filming that.
What's the hacker's guy? The
Newman.
Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden. Like there was the Snowden thing. There was Russia. There was like privacy stuff and like refugee crisis. It like didn't fucking make any sense. And then there was like the ISIS stuff. It didn't make any sense at all. I'm sorry. I think that they were like, oh, we want to do something about Snowden because they told us about that when we were in Washington. And also we need to talk about their refugee crisis. And also we should talk about like Russia and Berlin and Europe. And I was just like, it didn't make any sense. Season 6 didn't make any sense because they rewrote it halfway through and stuff that happened in the beginning didn't matter in the end. It's really funny that you mentioned that. There was an Alex Gonza interview in the Hollywood Reporter that was just released today that I posted on the blog, and he talked about that, and he said that he like actually said, you know, more or less that viewers don't necessarily want to see real life mirrored back to them, like, and so we want to make an effort to be entertaining, which means that we need to tell Carrie Matheson's story.
I'm paraphrasing, finally get that right.
I'm paraphrasing here, but that's kind of what he said. And then the press still asks about it because I think to them it's really interesting because it allows them to tap into this insatiable desire for like news and current events and stuff like that. But I also think they realize that you can't be prescient in the age of Donald Trump. You just can't. Like news cycles are like half a day. The news comes out too fast and every single thing is more batshit crazy bananas than you could ever imagine. You just can't try to predict that because you can't try to predict the behavior of crazy people. Like you can't do that. You're just going to end up writing a show that's like garbled nonsense. And so I was very relieved to like hear him say that. We'll have to see if it actually pans out. Again, I'm kind of getting my hopes up and I know I shouldn't, but I was relieved to hear him say that, I guess.
Well, he's on the clock.
Like I said,
he doesn't have infinite time.
Yeah.
In season 5, so the prescience sort of like got into full swing in season 5 and it became a real thing that they were lauded for after the
Paris attack happened.
And it was, they were filming that scene the same day. And everyone was like, wow, this is real life happening like on our screens. And I think they just got really into that. And I think they were so excited about the fact that they had this one thing that was just very different from all of these competing shows that they just decided to run for it and to swing for the fences. They missed.
Understatement of the century.
And look at the difference, right? Because now they only have 2 seasons left. That's 24 mm-hmm. episodes unless they extend. 24, Ashley. They're on the clock. There is a time crunch. They have to get – season 7 is probably the – is the bridge right to the end. They're going to need to get all of their characters, you know, by 8-1 emotionally and physically to where they want them to be for that end run. And what does that story look like that they want to tell? What, you know, where is Carrie in all of this? Where do they see her ending up? I think for the first time, probably since the early seasons, they know. I would make a guess that they have a lot of this done. It's probably some of the finesse of the storylines, you know, and maybe specific plots within it. But I have a sense that they have more direction now than they have in a long time. You could feel it in that episode. I think one of the things I didn't like about the episode was that it was very convoluted. I just thought that because there was so much going on, because they were so ambitious, I think it was a little chaotic. I'd be interested to hear from casual viewers if they were lost while they were watching it, because I just felt like, you know, even I was like, oh yeah, that's so-and-so. Like, and I watch, you know, these episodes obsessively. So I feel like it was just a little convoluted, which encourages me that I think they're going to thin this out and streamline the story to take them through, you know, to 8-1. And I think, God, hope Brett O'Keefe is the first one to go because I just can't.
We should do a podcast with casual viewers.
My mom is a casual viewer. She can usually track things pretty well, though. But I don't know if that's because she talks to me.
Probably. Like, if my husband, like, I know a couple of casual viewers, and I'm like, I wonder what they would think. And I wanted to ask them, but they didn't watch immediately because they're normal people.
So my feeling, I understand kind of what you mean about convoluted. There was a lot going on. You know how, like, in most Homeland episodes, there's always, like, a filler scene that you could take out and it wouldn't matter. It's like you could just take it out. It's whatever. It doesn't matter. It's just like extra time. None of those scenes were like that. And I even say like no lines of dialogue just felt like filler dialogue. I felt like every single thing that came out of an actor's mouth, every single like move of the camera was significant and important to the story, which means it was really, really tight.
I would argue that Alex.
Completely agree.
That, Brett O'Keefe was not necessary.
I think that you could take him out, but also people would probably be wondering, like, if you're going to make the decision to focus on what happened to McClendon, you're also going to make the decision to focus on O'Keefe, and also they're setting up Saul to then, like, hunt him down. So you have to kind of be like, where is he? Oh, he's on the run. Whatever. Blah, blah, blah.
Well, and he was one of the dudes in that plot.
Yeah,
in,
I know.
In
like,
612.
He
was, like,
the
guy.
He's
right.
He's a fugitive.
He's
right.
on the run now. And I think it's interesting is, like, is his network, like, what does his network look like? Because clearly he's not, he doesn't have a base of operations, you know, with his arrest warrant. You can make some assumptions about the technology he no longer has access to. That he had, you know, where Max, you know, had infiltrated before, which means in my mind, I think that they're using him more now as a mouthpiece and like a rabble rouser. And I think, you know, for me, I hope that correlates to his lifespan on the show. But because, you know, girlfriend Sharon is never seeing that cat again. Can we just say like she's never going home to her cat?
Oh my God, that poor cat.
She's never going to see that cat.
I kind of felt for her. They were like eating KFC on this like gross
when
mattress,
they were talking about
reading
how cheap
4chan. And I was like, this poor woman. Like, I know that she's chosen to do this, but also like this poor fucking woman and her poor cat. I just felt I actually fell for her at that moment.
And like, what was so interesting about Brett O'Keefe that she was like willing to drop her entire life for that? But
I don't know, she doesn't seem like a zealot, right? She doesn't seem like a zealot.
They were eating KFC like as soon as they said he made the comment about he was reading from 4chan about how America's great because of XYZ, but the fast food is cheap. And then I looked and like, what is she eating? And I was like, they're eating KFC.
Yeah, they're eating KFC. I could totally leave the Brett O'Keefe scenes in perspective, given what we had in season 6, which was just like, oh, good Lord, like, I can't watch this. I felt like it was a lot more watchable, actually. They were short.
I completely agree.
And he was kind of funny. Like, he had a lot of really funny lines, I thought. And so I enjoyed it much more than when he was just, like, sitting in the studio just, like, yelling at the screen. I much more preferred him interacting with real people outside of, like, the guys and the veil of, like, his radio show.
I would like to state for the record that O'Keefe's accent does not bother me.
It also doesn't bother me. And I'm usually someone who's really bothered by accents. We got another thing about – so we've gotten tons over the last year about his accent. We've got a lot of asks about that. And we got one today about
Wellington's
too.
Wellington's way more fucked up.
What?
I was listening – Wellington's was way more fucked
that
up.
That one also doesn't
where...
bother me. It's kind of like Northeastern a little bit. I feel like he's
it's
from
Northeastern,
like
but he's – no, no.
It had a little bit of
French twang.
No, but it wasn't like a Southern twang. I felt like it was much more Northeast.
Sarah, I don't trust you to recognize Southern accents. Because let me just briefly segue into a story about how Sarah and I went to lunch at an inn in Vermont. And our waitress had a really thick accent. And Sarah, where did you think she was from? Indiana?
I think I thought she was from, like, Missouri or something.
And I was like, she's from the South. And Sarah was like, no, I grew up in the South. I know my Southern accents. And she came over to the table and I said, where are you from? And she goes, Savannah. Which is the same.
Oh, okay.
Sarah grew up in Georgia.
But it didn't sound like kind of like a Paula Deen style Southern accent, though. And
no, but it was a Southern accent nonetheless.
Yeah, but it was kind of weird. It was kind of a weird accent. She'd been living in Vermont, so it was weird. Hello.
People don't necessarily lose their accents when they move.
Okay. People David Wellington's accent does not bother me. I didn't even know that he was not American. I did not know that he was not American.
I didn't. Once it was pointed out to me, I noticed.
Is he Australian?
I think he's British. Let me Google that.
I don't know.
I think he's British.
It doesn't bother me. And, like, I'm someone who actually don't get bothered by accents. Like, I couldn't watch
English.
House of Cards because
Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, because Kevin Spacey's accent was so horrible to me. And as a person that's from the South, I was like, that's a horrible, like, butchering of a Southern accent beyond all the other shit that's wrong with Kevin Spacey, clearly. But I was just like, no, I can't get into the show because his accent's so bad. Wellington's doesn't bother me. I was trying to place it and be like, where is he supposed to be from? I feel like he's trying to do some version of a New Yorker.
There is nowhere in the United States that has the accent that he is doing, and he doesn't have the generic accent either. Like, I have the generic accent, but I also kind of sound like a valley girl. Like, we're just going there. But he doesn't have anything that I could place. It's just a hodgepodge.
This reminds me of, there was a season of American Horror Story. I think it was the Freak Show one with Kathy Bates. And she played the bearded lady. And she attempted some bizarro mashup of, like, a Southern accent with a Baltimore accent. And people were like, what the fuck is her? Like,
at least that's the Mason-Dixon line, right?
Yeah, but there was, like, a whole meme about Kathy Bates' accent because people were like, what the fuck is this accent? It didn't place any place in America how people talked.
Nobody can – accents are – Matt and Ben are worse at the Boston accent than I am. Just leaving it there.
Well, here, let's say this, right? So you got Wellington and O'Keefe. O'Keefe is straight up going to have a heart attack. I predict he's gone in a couple of episodes. I can't cut it, okay? He's done. And so we're not going to have it much longer. And with Wellington, truthfully, it doesn't bother me. And I feel like his story will override any, you know, harboring... you know, accent issues people have. I think it's going to pay off. But O'Keefe, he's pale, he's sweaty. We haven't really talked about that. He doesn't look to be in poor health. He's eating fast food. He's on the run. He's under stress.
He was sweating like a mofo.
Yeah, he just, his armpits and everything. Sharon, girlfriend that will never see her cat again, made a comment about how... he, hey, careful with that makeup. Last time, you know, you look like a corpse and, right. Or a ghost, or I'm not sure how she characterized him, but, I don't know. I just felt like, you know, his storyline, I think, serves the purpose to some degree for the audience of the both sides or ism that Homeland does is, you know, we're not thrilled with Keen and neither is he. And isn't that uncomfortable that in some ways we're agreeing with what he's saying, even if we don't agree with the methodology or like the actual use of the language that he's like using? It's icky. It doesn't feel great to be like, yeah, Brett Keefe, let's get her out of here. You know what I mean? But also he's culpable in who she's become because the Keen we met, whether, you know, the Gons had changed it or not, the Keen we met was not the Keen we see now. And he is one of the main drivers, him and Dar and McClendon and that little deep state, you know, death trio. They're the reason why she's lost her shit. And she is paranoid because of it. And had that not happened, there would have been a different president and Hillary Clinton would be in the Oval Office. So life would have been a lot different. But I think that, you know, but I think the show, what they've done well is I believe her paranoia now. I felt before it was forced, that last scene of 6:12, where she's, you know, not letting Carrie in and she's just kind of on her iPad and it's dark and closed off. I was like, really? All of this whole season for her to be this now? I didn't buy it. I was angry. I buy it now. I get it. Seeing her in that courtroom, you know, she lost her shit when McClendon didn't sit down. And you see it in her body language. It's like that stifled rage. That's why she went off script. That's why she called for the death penalty. And that's why you see her, you know, Tony Sopranoing it in the Oval Office, you know, later in the episode. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see is, you know, where do we draw the line, right? Where do we agree with these characters? Where do we disagree with them? And that's part of the ride of what Carrie's going to go through is it's not all black and white. It's going to be very gray. And, you know, whose side will she ultimately be on at the end?
I don't know how smart this comment is, but...
What a great way to preface something that you're about to say.
I have a couple of really smart comments, and by which I mean one of them is about the fact that Brett O'Keefe is driving around in a wood-paneled station wagon from the 80s.
This show really likes its station wagons.
Wood-paneled, though.
They love an extended cab.
The Brody... family had a station wagon. Carrie drove a station wagon last season. They're like,
but this one is straight out of National Lampoon. like my note in my phone says simply Griswold, all caps. Anyway,
full disclosure: whenever I'm driving on the highway and I'm like about to pass one of those like huge trucks, I always think of the scene where they're driving to go get the Christmas tree and they're literally driving beneath the truck at one point, and I'm like, that's actually not physically possible.
Whenever my friends and I used to see like a wood panel truck or wood panel station wagon, because you don't see them anymore, we would hit the roof and go Griswold. Anyway, so one thing that actually did interest me with regard to what Gail is just saying about Keen and how her state of mind was a little more believable here was the fact that Elizabeth Marvel played Mark Antony in the Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar. And this show was very, very widely, it was acclaimed. It was incredibly good. Cynthia and I went to see it. But also there was a lot of backlash because of the fact that Caesar was portrayed as Trump. And I feel like the character of Antony in the play is very much one of gray areas. Like, he is bringing Rome, everyone's angry at Caesar, and then he dies, and then he brings Rome together in honor of Caesar. And I think that, like, I wonder how much playing that role for an entire summer before she got into Elizabeth Keen again really affected her performance, because I think it affected it a lot. That's my theater nerd comment. One of my other comments was that Gail mentioned earlier, like, they've got Keen on the ropes. Well, in the previously on, they didn't mention Quinn, but they did have Dar saying, we've got her on the ropes. And then in the episode, Brett O'Keefe said the same thing, we've got her on the ropes. That felt significant that they showed that in the previously on and then said it again in the episode.
Thoughts? I wonder if she's going to be on the ropes.
I hope that she wrestles in like a ring.
Hey, she can fight Alex Jones in the boxing match.
No, that's Jake Weber. Jake Weber's the boxer.
I know, but we can't stop hearing about that. She could do it.
I know.
She's on the ropes.
She's wicked on the ropes.
Wicked on the ropes. Can you say that in a Boston accent, please?
No.
All right, do we have anything left to discuss?
Yeah, the fact that the only person who believes Carrie, like, at all is legit and has any psychological standing whatsoever is her 16-year-old niece.
What are you trying to say?
I I'm trying to say that when I was 16, I believed a lot of really stupid shit. And I like to think that at the tender age of 33, the same year that Jesus lived to, I would see through that shit. And it says a lot to me that the only person who is actually completely engaged with Carrie is her 16-year-old niece. She's a teenager. Her brain won't be finished growing for 9 years.
All right, we're done. I'm done with this conversation now.
Can you imagine?